Hi, it's Mike. It's Saturday. It's the Saturday Show. Every week on Saturday, we take one from the week and one from the vaults, pair them together, and give them to you. This week, I did a rather long spiel about the travails of podcasting, specifically public radio podcasting, WBZ, the big station in Chicago, cut staff, canceled podcasts. This has been a trend. It's happened in Colorado. It's happened in New York. It happened with the NPR itself. And then there are similar things happening at WAMU and the LA public radio station. Just the podcasting arm of it has been decimated in the listening has been more than decimated, a 30% drop off from pre-pandemic numbers. So in my spiel, I talked about that and I tried to puzzle out why. And I, perhaps alone among people with a stake or a former stake in public radio, offered the premise that it was the programming. It wasn't just the programming. There were cross currents and headwinds, but the programming has and had a lot to do with why listeners are no longer tuning into public radio as much as they had. And I know the public radio world says, no, it's because of listening trends. It's because of an aging population. But I also think it bears paying attention to what the programming they have and had been putting out is, how it differs from what people liked, and how it became an embrace of let's do some stuff that the listeners don't like. Maybe they would say they don't know they're going to like it, but it turned out they didn't like it. So I talked a lot in my spiel, probably too much, at length about programming choices and appealing to the public radio listener. But I don't just want to offer complaints or even complaints and analysis. I want to offer solutions. And I actually had a solution in the form of Jeremy Hobson.
Welcome to The Middle. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Tolliver is here as always. Hey, Tolliver, we have some news.
Jeremy has a show called The Middle. It's produced by Illinois Public Broadcasting. It's doing really well. It's a live call-in show. It harkens back to a lot of the public radio that people who once loved public radio and like it a little less now, that kind of programming that they liked.
Let's get to the phones because we've got a lot of calls coming in. Olivia is with us from North Las Vegas, Nevada. Olivia, welcome to The Middle. Go ahead with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hi, my name's Olivia. I'm 12, and I'm from North Las Vegas. Before I get into the question, I just wanted to say I am a big science nerd, and I'm a really big
fan. Jeremy hosted a show called Here and Now, which was essentially took the mantle from Talk of the Nation, another beloved show. And by the way, we're going to have Ray Suarez on soon to talk about his new book on immigration. But Jeremy was either let go or cleaved from the world of Here and Now. And he wanted to do a show that was a little bit of a hearkening back to the better times of let's get together and talk about the middle of the country, and maybe the political center and just the center of tensions and passions in the country. And like I said, it's doing well. Well, when Jeremy was on the show, we talked all about his new project. We touched a little bit about the state of media, but then I talked to him for another 15 or so minutes just about our shared times in public media, his analysis of what's going on in public radio and public media, how his new show, The Middle, is a countervailing force to that. We put it behind a paywall. I wasn't sure that I wanted to, quote unquote, bore all the listeners who didn't pay for it or didn't want to hear it with that part of the show, but I'm taking it out from behind the paywall now. I think it pairs well with my analysis of public broadcasting. So you will hear first my spiel about all the canceled podcasts, the carnage in public radio, and then we will hear and heretofore only available to subscribers, people who go to subscribe.mikepesca.com and pay for an ad-free version or pay for extra content. It is one way, really the best way, to keep a podcast such as this afloat in what is clearly tenuous times. So here now, the spiel and that interview with Jeremy. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel, audio carnage at NPR. There are so many layoffs and cancellations occurring in the world of public media. It doesn't make me happy. Friends of mine have lost their jobs. And quite selfishly, podcasts I love will no longer be available for listening. That happened, a once-loved podcast that is no more. That happened and played out a couple of years ago. And the podcast was Invisibilia. It was hosted by one of the greatest radio reporters I've ever worked with, Elise Spiegel, veteran of This American Life, alongside Lulu Miller, who is also this kind of radio genius with a background from Radiolab. By season two, the show had hit its stride, adding Hannah Rosin, who wasn't an audio person then, but is one now, a great one, hosting the Atlantic's podcast. Invisibilia was everything I loved about audio storytelling and the NPR way of tackling an issue, engaging an audience, and bringing abstract concepts to life.
What do you think, Lulu? Do you think that you can teach cheerful? Welcome to the second season of Invisibilia. I'm Elise Spiegel.
And I'm Lulu Miller.
Invisibilia is a show about all of the invisible forces that shape human behavior, our emotions, our beliefs,
our expectations.
And our question today is, can you take an emotional norm and transform it?
Right. Are these large, invisible, seemingly intractable?
The original gang broke up. This was, or their success was, near the dawn of the podcast boom. They were all lured away. Today, Lulu's hosting her old show, Radiolab, and Elise is back at This American Life. Retreat to quality, I guess. But what happened to Invisibilia since, I think, is instructive. New hosts took over, Yowie Shaw and Kia Miyaka Natisse, and a new sensibility emerged. In the past, the illumination that Invisibilia provided was mostly on issues of the psychological, sometimes the sociological. They did stories about race, violence, perspectives, but it was always grounded in scholarship, or at least I would say there was some interesting study or finding the host could point to. Under the new host, things changed, and change could be good, but then things veered off track. So Invisibilia had an episode about a black woman who set up a GoFundMe-type account for any white people who were feeling guilty. The ethical dimensions of this weren't, again, to my ear, weren't fully interrogated, as they say. It was just this fun kind of thing. They did a story about an introverted, to the point of paralysis, stand-up comic. And this comic's therapist was a former dominatrix. This, by the way, is a great premise for a movie or a sitcom or a podcast story. But the story they did on the show, a show that was once grounded in science, was just kind of confusing about everything. Then in 2021, they ran a story about trains, about slow trains. The idea was we all exist in such a fast twitch, attention-laden environment. It might be soothing to put on a program where a camera just traces the landscape as seen from the side of a slow-moving train. By the way, that actual show is popular in Norway. So here's a clip of the Invisibilia reporter talking to Eric Schatz, a TV producer who had pitched the idea of the slow-moving train to U.S. executives.
His idea of driving across part of California. Sure, it could be a beautiful meditation on our landscape, kind of like a visual version of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. But not everybody hears that song or sees America's landscape the same way, right? Here's Fred Turner, the media historian, again.
The idea of driving across the American landscape inside a vehicle and marveling and feeling like it was ours, that's pretty hard in a place where just 150 years ago, European settlers wiped out, you know, several million Native Americans, where slavery occurred. You know, those kinds of things make that celebration of the land very difficult.
This show is not about that. It's not about what's right or wrong with our country. It's not the show for that. You go to watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News if you want to fight about that.
I kept pressing the point. What you film is a political decision. Eric pressed back.
Like, just chill out and watch. Take it in. Calm down. Turn down the temperature. Look at this fucking Zen moment in the middle of nothing.
I said that was, you know, a privileged perspective to take.
Invisibilia, like much of NPR, and maybe much of progressive America, had gone insane. NPR and public radio, long stymied by an audience that's whiter and older than their workforce, and an audience that is whiter and older than NPR's ideal for their audience, began to program differently. Too many inside of public radio, this was long overdue. A debate broke out in newsrooms, not just public radio newsrooms, everywhere, about objectivity. Leadership was publicly called out on past failures of such issues as diversification. Just like everywhere else in media and society, the aims and opinions of lower-level staffers began to flood the traditional studied reasonableness, you might say, overly cautious studiousness that the network was known for. All across public radio, they began to redefine who the programming was for. I, as a listener, as a former employee, understood this. I heard a lot the explanation, you know, Mike, not everything is for you. Not everything needs to be for a 40 or 50-something-year-old straight white person. Fair. Eventually, it began to feel like not everything needs to be for you went from an explanation to something of a mission statement. Here's a program that was greenlit at the time called Louder Than a Riot. Season one was about rap music and incarceration. NPR.org describes the second season this way, quote, season two of Louder Than a Riot examines who hip-hop marginalizes, how misogynoir, the specific racist misogyny against black women, is embedded into the fabric of the culture that we love. And that is exactly what the program delivered.
It's me, Chameleon, and two older white men just having a blast that night.
Oh,
like, just
God.
Running around the streets of Miami.
The four of them were getting turned at the same club Aida and Chameleon had just been filming the show at a few days earlier and was set to film at again. You could say they were getting ratchet for the sake of research. Aida stepped away for a second to go to the bathroom, and apparently the club staff had a problem with that.
I'm trying to use one of the bathrooms, and they're like, this is for the employees, ma'am. You can't pee here. But I'm already in the stall peeing, so that's crazy.
And she made me mad because she walked in on my girl peeing. I'm like, bitch, what is you doing?
I'm calling the cops. Get out. You're going to jail.
I'm like,
girl,
you call whoever you want to call.
This is NPR? Well, it was. And you know what? It wasn't a mistake. It was a huge break from what NPR had sounded like and what the rest of NPR pretty much still sounds like, which many within NPR regarded as what it sounded like was exactly the problem. I think that show, Louder Than a Riot, by the way, I think it's well done. If you judge a show on the basis of, does it have a vision? Does it ably achieve that vision? Louder Than a Riot does. But it's such a break with what NPR had always been that management and staff should have known that it was very unlikely to find a large audience. And as these things go, it cost a lot. NPR is a brand that doesn't complement the programming of Louder Than a Riot. Again, you could say, that's right, but it should. Except it doesn't. My point is, it doesn't. It was unlikely that this show was going to become a hit. That doesn't mean it shouldn't have been made. It just means that it should have been made with considerations given to the uphill climb that it faced, given how different it was from everything else NPR had been. I mean, think about, you have this brand, NPR as a brand means something. You want to move or shift or nudge the brand, but how do you do that? Well, maybe you could use the fact that you have a giant terrestrial audience and a giant podcast audience to point to other programming. This is basically the only way that podcast discovery works. So there on NPR, it's, well, thank you, Stuart Eisenstadt, former Undersecretary of the Treasury in the Carter administration. And now, here's a clip from a new NPR podcast you might enjoy.
Man, Tuesday was so Atlanta off jump. Because here's the thing about the trap capital. Everybody's got a side hustle. It ain't just the doughboys and the dancers. Even the real estate agents got a trap mentality.
That is the epitome of programming not made for me. And by the way, I think I have some perspective on not for me programming on NPR, because for years I delivered sports to the NPR audience, who mostly would be inclined to say sports, not for me. So I knew ways to do this, and I knew that I could use some jargon, some argot, right? I could probably say the high pick and roll. I don't know that I'd want to, but I definitely couldn't say, well, you know, you got to watch the back screens when you're in a matchup zone. And this isn't terribly complex verbiage for the sports fan. Watch the NCAA tournament games this weekend. Over 10 million people will be watching, and an announcer will definitely say something about back screens and matchup zones. But the classic way of doing things on NPR was to meet the audience halfway, part of the way. Louder Than a Riot and a few other shows with it eschewed that formula, which is fine, but again, management and staff had to know that that would make the show's success quite unlikely. And even with shows like with Invisibilia, where none of the words or phrases or concepts would be foreign to an NPR listener, there is just this assumption of shared ideology rather than just make your case when your case relies so much on fairly new ideas, ways of thinking, ways of speaking, and assumptions. All of this trying new things, trying different things, somewhat radical breaks, or very radical breaks from what had come before. That's okay. That's what innovation demands, right? And it is public radio. They make decisions all the time saying, okay, this might challenge the audience. This might not be a huge audience hit, but we think it's worth it artistically or journalistically. We'll let the success of, say, a Planet Money pay for two or three or four of these passion projects. Only NPR found itself paying for 5 or 10 or 15 of them. And when I say NPR, I mean the same is true for all of public radio. In the past few months, big public radio stations in Chicago, New York, Colorado, Washington, D.C. have fired staff, have canceled podcasts. There are many reasons, but you'd have to cite the programming choices and programming changes at the network and at the stations as contributing to the lack of appeal to the audience. I'm not sure they will have to credit the lack of appeal. But if you had the leeway to really do a self-examination of why the programming failed to connect, I would think you'd have to at least consider the content. I know there are so many excuses out there. A lot of the excuses are valid. I read a lot of stories about how NPR listening has been sadly affected, plunged after the pandemic, the drive time radio audience, and the idea is that the same kind of unplugging as happened on broadcast TV is happening with radio listening. And that did happen. NPR's listenership is down by 15 or 20% since 2018 or 2019. But you know what? Commercial radio hasn't been affected that way. AM and FM radio is actually not down much, if anything at all. And the Sean Hannity or finance guy Dave Ramsey or screecher Mark Levin, they're still holding their rather huge audiences. In a way, NPR and Morning Edition and All Things Considered aren't. Same with their podcasts. I mean, you want to argue that, oh, NPR listeners just shifted to podcast. Well, NPR radio listenership went from a weekly average of 29 million in 2019 to 24 million in the year 2022, the last year for figures. And in 2019, according to NPR's annual report, podcast listeners were at 11.2 million a week. They actually increased in the next year. But last year for which there's a report, it's down to 8 million a week. They're leaving NPR, public radio, is leaving listeners behind. And I do think in part it's because they were programming to the audience they wanted, which is fine and aspirational, but at the same time they ignored, or in some cases even disdained, the audience they had. But audience was never their number one goal. It seems crazy, but I'll give you this quote, which isn't rare and wasn't uttered once and then backtracked. This is what John Lansing, then the NPR chief executive, believed. Their number one goal was, quote, to reach a younger, more diverse audience and to expand NPR into parts of the American community that have otherwise not really found maybe so much resonance with NPR. This is their North Star, not my description. John Lansing would always describe their DEI initiatives as their North Star. Their DEI officer says in interviews, this is our North Star. And on that, I think they've been successful. For the 2021 fiscal year, their hirings were only 22% white people. Frequently, public radio spokespeople will point out that even though the overall audience has declined, the audience that's left is more diverse than it was before. Left unsaid is the fact that you can achieve that effect by merely losing lots of white people as listeners without actually gaining people of color. When NPR announced the layoffs of the staffs of Invisibilia, Louder Than a Bomb, and a couple other podcasts, and 84 total employees, Bloomberg's Ashley Carman reported that tensions boiled over. During an all-staff meeting, John Lansing, who was CEO at the time, asked upset employees to, quote, turn down the rhetoric and not call executives out by name in an all-hands with hundreds of attendees. Quote, I would never, ever, on your worst day, call you out by name in a meeting with 827 people, he said. Carmen goes on to report some employees interpreted this as tone policing and felt uncomfortable. They immediately took to Zoom and called Lansing's response racist and out of line. Another staff member dropped a link to a segment from NPR's Code Switch titled, When Civility is Used as a Cudgel Against People of Color. Civility is a weapon wielded by the powerful, one person wrote, according to the screenshots of the chat viewed by Bloomberg. This meeting has made me more afraid for the future of public media than any conversation I have had in a very long time, wrote another. Well, I'm afraid that public radio is in a very lamentable and possibly non-correctable position. I don't know that they'll ever be able to course correct given the culture of public radio. The excuses are built right in. The priorities are for something other than audience growth. And the conception is that critiques like mine either aren't in good faith or I'm sure will be interpreted as a desire to get back to the older, boring, white person way of programming. I just ask public radio, NPR, to consider the idea that if the message stated or unstated is that, hey, not everything needs to be for you, sooner rather than later, a lot of listeners or former listeners, when asked why they no longer listen, will answer, I felt like it wasn't for me. So we interviewed Jeremy Hobson back in June, and you can still access that show, of course, and hear about his show, The Middle. And then I asked a question, which was behind a paywall. Now it's not. And the first question I asked was, you know, what's your analysis of what's going on in public radio? Let's join the discussion from that question.
Look, I think there are a lot of reasons. I think that they would have you believe that the only reason is because everybody's habits shifted during the COVID pandemic. But I don't think that's true because people obviously still want to listen to audio content all the time. It is the one medium that you can consume while you are doing something else, whether it's driving or exercising or working. And I think that that's important to remember. Look, personally, I think one reason is it has gotten way too scripted. It has lost sort of the fun to listen to unpredictability that it has had over the course of time.
Now, listeners might be saying unpredictable. That's not a word I associate with public radio. But what you mean is, I think among the things you mean, scripted. We will often hear a host interviewing a reporter. It's called a two-way in the business. And when I was doing it, I would maybe give the host, if you were the host, an idea of where I wanted to go, but ask the questions and I'll answer the questions.
Right.
But now, well, you tell me you were inside more recently. That's anathema in the world of public radio.
Look, they don't want to get anything wrong. And so they want to have an editor decide, okay, this is what you can ask this person and this, and they're going to answer like this. And also because the schedule of the day has gotten so tight, like this story has to be 3 minutes and 25 seconds. And then the next story is going to come on and it's going to be 4 minutes and 32 seconds. That is a problem because then you can't really play around at all. It's like, if I ask this person this question, you've heard it 1,000 times on Morning Edition where they are about, they're doing a live interview with
Jeremy,
somebody.
We have to leave it there. Jeremy,
yeah, exactly,
thank you so much.
Exactly.
You know what? That's a great thought,
right,
but we do
yeah,
have to
right.
run. We do
I'm
have
like,
to leave
come
it
on,
there.
Guys.
Up against a break.
Look, I mean, we have hard breaks on the middle too, but that hasn't happened yet, knock on wood.
Yeah, well, it depends on when you let the call on the air. If it's 20 seconds before the break, you're definitely screwed. Who are your heroes of call-in radio?
Oh, so like there was a guy named David Brudnoy who used to host a commercial show on WBZ in Boston that I used to listen to in college.
Uh-huh.
He was just amazing. Apparently, he would do it in his apartment in the Back Bay, and he'd have just these long, really lovely conversations. Tom Snyder on the old Late Late Show, not call-in, but like still same
deal.
No,
he would also take calls sometimes based on, you know, in the 12:30 hour.
Yeah.
And he would have those flecks of spittle in the corners of his
well,
mouth.
And
that
smoking
were so endearing.
A cigarette, right?
Yeah.
Look, I used to love watching Larry King Live when I was a
but were
you teenager.
Eight? You were eight.
No,
you were hosting
no,
your radio treehouse.
He was on in the 90s. By the way, I will say that one thing that I do kind of appreciate about this is that the middle is on at the exact same time, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 6 Pacific, as Larry King Live was on. But apparently he used to go to Nate Nall's in Beverly Hills, have his like 2 hour, you know, lunch, show up to the office an hour before the show, not know anything about what he was going to do, but it would be a good conversation.
And have you ever said, caller, walla walla,
no,
you're
right,
on the air.
No, or like, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, hello.
Questions for Miss Piggy. I was partial to the Ray Suarez era
oh, yeah.
of Talk of the Nation.
Yeah.
And I think a lot was lost when NPR got out of that game.
Yeah. And by the way, this is the only show in public radio nationally that takes live calls right now.
Is that right?
Yes. Because 1A
wow.
now doesn't take live calls anymore. On Point doesn't take live calls anymore. Think doesn't take live calls anymore.
Why?
And
because
Talk of the Nation went away in 2013.
They've all shifted to podcast or why?
Because they do the you know, car talk model where people call in, leave a message, and they decide who they want to call back. And then they call
yeah.
that person back. It's easy, more easy to control. But you lose
yeah.
a lot from that,
you do.
I think.
But
look,
you,
by
you
the
also
way, we're
lose
getting...
a lot when you get a really bad caller and they hijack the show. And that's where a good host, Brian Lehrer, is very
yes.
good at that.
Yes,
he
Brian
can take
Lehrer's
the worst caller and somehow get a good question out of it, even if the person was calling about lizards in the subway. Well, let's talk about infrastructure, you know, whatever it is.
Look, and by the way, I've learned a couple of things over the course of the, you know, my career. One of them, Tom Ashbrook, the former host of On Point, used to say, "We've got it," after like a little, after the person starts going
yes.
up, "Okay,
yes.
okay, Frank, we've got it. Thanks so much for that call." He just moves on and it's very polite and nice and we get moving. And then the other-
Right, sometimes he would even go, "We got it, we know it, we hear you."
Right.
Like he
yeah.
would say it 3 or 4
yes,
times,
right.
make them
exactly.
feel okay about
exactly.
it. And the listeners loved him for that, loved him for hustling the blowhard or, you know, the person who just got a little tongue tied off the air.
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, as I was sort of doing the promotion for the middle when we were starting, I went on all these local public radio talk shows around the country and I was on one and the host would take calls and she would say, "Go ahead." And I was like, "Oh, that's clever." Like, "Hey," so I've done that on the middle a ton now. I'm like, "Hey, welcome to the middle. Go ahead." Like, "Okay, I don't have time for how are you? What's going on?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, "Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. Let's just do it. Let's get to your point."
Oprah's was, caller, you say what? So has the art of call screening atrophied with no public radio shows taking calls anymore? No,
in fact, we have the newest system. Illinois Public Media is our broadcast partner. And as we started this show, they bought this brand new system that allows my call screeners to be anywhere in the country from home, and me to be anywhere and to put the callers on and off the air from my computer, which is amazing because, like, you know, I have a screen in front of me. I see the 10 calls. My senior producer is in another location. She's giving me, you know, oh, go to, you know, Tom in Oklahoma City next or whatever. And it's all done remotely. So in that sense, it has changed. But no, the actual what they have to do is the same.
I hope by contract the whole staff is somewhere in the central time zone.
No, the staff is all over the country. We have one person in Kansas City, though.
You are, oh my God, what a radical sellout of the ideal of the show.
It's not just the geographic middle, Mike. It's all the middles.
So I do want to ask you one more thing. I read the Beyond Intractability newsletter, and these are a couple of academics. They're in the depolarization camp. I've gotten deep into depolarization. And what I realize is it's a choice. It's not just an ideal. It's not pie in the sky. It's not the equivalent of kindness. Sometimes when you put the virtue of depolarization up high, certain things have to go lower. And I have concluded, and this is debate in the literature, the tension between activism and depolarization. And there are some, the people who run the Beyond Intractability newsletter, academics named Guy and Heidi Burgess, they will say that depolarization, if you really want to have depolarization, sometimes you sacrifice activism. Where there are other peace experts, Lisa Surich of Notre Dame says that advocacy and activism has to come first to shift power and increase awareness of justice. And only when power becomes closer to balance does she advocate engaging in dialogue to build coalitions. So that's how I see it. I do think it's a choice. And I think whether you know it or not, it's very hard to be all things to all people. And you are making a choice. Whereas the choice in public radio has been more of a, we have to advocate more for marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. Do you think you could have it all? Do you think that I've laid out a false dichotomy, or do you buy that to some extent?
I don't think that it is the role of a journalist to be an activist. I mean, there are people who want to be activist journalists. That is a different kind of journalism, that like Rachel Maddow and Sean Hannity. That's not the kind of journalism that I want to do. And I don't think if you're working for a news organization where you are, you know, selling yourself as trying to be as unbiased as you possibly can and really hear from all sides, that is not your, if you want to go be an activist, there are plenty of organizations you can go work for that can do that. But if you want to go into a news organization, that's not your role.
I agree. But do you think all news organizations agree?
No, of course not. This is a big, big question. I just saw a tweet from a producer at a public radio show the other day that said, you know, basically talking about Gaza, and was like, if we're not here to advocate for these people, then what are we even doing? You know,
that's, I have an answer to that. What's okay. your answer?
What's your answer?
Telling the story.
Yes.
Being
right,
accurate.
Right.
Allowing
exactly.
others outside of ourselves to come to honest and earnest conclusions.
Well, and this is the thing that has driven me nuts over the years about people that I work with who will go out and tweet something that's like blatantly political. And I'm like, you realize that when you do that, you are basically, your name is associated with this news organization. So you're basically saying to everybody who wants to say that this news organization is biased, that in fact we are biased. And if you feel like your most powerful role is your Twitter account, instead of the fact that you can book a guest for this program, or you can, you know, write this story, you can give, you know, you can do the research that's needed in this, and you can shape the way that the story is going to come out. That's crazy. Like, why even bother? Who cares what you're writing on Twitter?
Well, you're 41, but also, as you've noted, a 32-year veteran of the business. So maybe that cuts both ways. So do you think people younger than you agree with you?
I don't think you can say that all people of a certain age feel one way or the other. I think that, of course, there are people younger than me that agree with me, and I think there are people older than me that agree with me, and there are people of all ages that disagree with me about
this. But don't you see a generational divide on this issue?
I think in terms of the people who are working in the business, I think more people that are younger generally have that the more I need to advocate view, but that's not to say all of them do. I have an incredible producer in his 20s, and he absolutely, you know, believes as I do that we need to try to be as balanced as we can and go searching for views that are not the same.
And do you think being on the different side of that divide than you are on the advocacy is the purpose of what we're doing here? Do you think that has had some effect on NPR or public radio listenership?
What has?
Embracing, not being explicit that our job is to tell the story and be truthful as opposed to advocate for outcomes.
I think that the pendulum is starting to swing a bit. Back and hopefully at NPR and other, you know, news organizations that you know, our role is to be credible across, to be trusted. I mean, the former, soon to be former CEO of NPR said that the North Star for him is diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think the North Star of any news operation needs to be truth and trust. And like that is, I think that there are more people now that feel that that is what needs to be the North Star of news organizations. Because if you don't have that, you're going to lose your whole audience. Because who cares? I mean, Mike, I've gone and taught in journalism classes over the years, and I always say, you need to be truthful, you need to be factual, you need to be fair, and you need to be fascinating. Because if you say something that's not true, people are going to disregard everything else that you say. If you're not fair, you're, I think, disregarding your role as a journalist. And if you are not fascinating, people will just change the channel. They're not going to listen to anything else that you say. You have the most factual, fair story in the world. If you're not interesting, nobody's going to care. And I think that's my sort of modus operandi.
I used to speak to some journalism-y type places or anyone who would ask, haven't been invited lately, but I had a similar thing where I would read the Ombudsman column and they would always be very clear to add more context and say fewer incorrect things. The typical Ombudsman and I shared a mindset in terms of credibility and not mixing journalism and activism. But I always would say we have an obligation to be interesting. And most of the grand poobahs of journalism never really put their finger on that. So I'm really glad that you add fascinating to that list. I thought that that would be where the debate or where the fracture might happen, the question of how interesting to be, because we could all agree that you can't be an activist. I'm surprised to learn that in the last few years, this question of is there such a thing as objectivity? Should we just say that it needs to be jettisoned? And can we mix activism with journalism? That was the fracture. It just is an interesting and, for me, unforeseen way that journalism's evolved.
Well, you and I were both at NPR at a time when they were bringing in a lot of newspaper reporters, I think, to like beef up their ability to, you know, break news and investigate and this and that. And there were a lot of great people that came in, but the focus was definitely not on let's be as fascinating as possible. The focus was like, let's compete with the New York Times. Now, there are people that broke through and could do both, like our mutual friend, David Folkenflik.
Right. Sullivan, David Folkenflik, Frank Langfitt. They were all in
absolutely
that group who
right
do both well. Yeah.
Right.
It's very true. It's very interesting. I think you're right that the pendulum is swinging. I haven't been in the world of public radio in a long time. I wonder what the people inside public radio who didn't want the pendulum to swing think about this. I wonder what the, now, as you say, the soon-to-be former CEO of NPR is leaving, but not for any diversity reasons or audience reasons, right?
No, I mean, I don't know what the reason is, but I will say, you know, he has overseen a terrible loss of talent. A lot of people had to be let go from NPR. The financial situation is a complete disaster. So, you know, maybe it was his choice, but it could have also easily been the board's choice. You know, this is not working out.
And so, as a corrective and just a fascinating listen, the third or fourth F, I don't know how many Fs there are, but is The Middle. It airs at 8 p.m. Central. I'm not going to do the math in your time zone. 8 p.m. Central on hundreds of public radio stations. And I listen on podcasts. I got to be honest.
Yeah. And by the way, please listen on the podcast, because that's where the look right now, the hardest thing about this, Mike, is I also own this show and I have to raise the money for it. And honestly, as we're going out and talking to foundations and this and that on the public radio side, if your listeners go and listen to the podcast and subscribe, it will be much easier for every effort for me in a big way.
Right now, Jeremy Hobson is in the middle of a funding crunch. Help him. No matter what he does, he can't help but do a pledge drive if you put him in front of a microphone for long enough. Jeremy Hobson is the host of The Middle, available on podcast and at 8 p.m. on hundreds of radio stations throughout the country. Listen, call. Listen at double speed on a podcast. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mike.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson is the senior producer. You know them as the Quaint Mallards. I know Michelle Pesca as the director of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is sponsored in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thank you for listening.